It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at the latest on Chris Christie's apology over a political scandal and what it means for the GOP presidential race. But first, all pink aisles in Toy Story, sexy Halloween costumes in tween sizes, and dolls that resemble pole dancers. Our guest cites all of those as examples to point out a problem. She thinks girlhood today is being co-opted and sexualized by manufacturers, marketers, and the media.
But she thinks parents can change it by raising awareness and getting active. We'd love to hear from you on this. Do you think being girly has a limited definition in our culture? Are you worried that girlhood is being over-sexualized and narrowed down to a pink aisle at the store? How do you combat stereotyping of girlhood, if you do? Or is this just harmless stuff and girls naturally like these things? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Melissa Atkins-Wardy joins us now. She's the author of the book Redefining Girly, How Parents Can Fight Stereotyping and Sexualizing of Girlhood from Birth to Tween. She also blogs at pigtailpals.com. Melissa joins us now from Janesville. Melissa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
When did you first have your aha moment when you realized you were seeing something that felt wrong to you with the cultural stuff surrounding girlhood, and it was up to you to do something about it?
Yeah, well, so that's a great question, because I think so many parents have either had or are coming to their aha moment. So for me, it started in college when I worked as a nanny, and this would have been in like 98, 99, 2000, which was the advent of Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera's careers outside of the whole Disney Kids complex. And my little 8-year-old that I nannied for would sing some of their songs or do some of their dance moves or come downstairs dressed like them. And I kept thinking, like, gosh, that's not right. That's kind of too grown up. But I didn't have a word for it, because at the time I didn't know the word sexualization. So I kind of had these tiny little things, like these little whisperings, but I didn't have the knowledge to put it all together. So my true aha moment came when my daughter was 6 months old and we were at Target and she was sitting up in the cart. And we were kind of going through the store looking for stuff, and I had to get a sippy cup for her. It was her first sippy cup. And the boys had different choices and different colors, and the girls, everything was pink and everything was princess. And, I mean, my daughter, as a baby, didn't know what she was looking at. It wouldn't have mattered if I had purchased girl or boy for her, whatever. But then we went over to the toy aisle, and it was the same thing. There were three aisles of pink, three aisles of blue, and then the themes of the toys within those two groups of aisles were night and day, and everything geared towards the girls focused on homemaking, animal care, fashion and beauty, and princesses. And I just kind of stood there, like, scratching my head, thinking, you know, this is the time, it was 2006, and I just thought, how is this even possible? So then I went to get some onesies for her, and again, it was the same thing, like, everything was pink, princess, talking about being sweet and pretty, and it just seemed like sort of this unnatural, I don't know, just wrongly defined sense of girlhood. Like, there were no other options.
And you said that once you see it, the way we limit and stereotype and sexualize girlhood, you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
So what did you decide to do about it?
So I started my apparel company first. It's Pigtail Pals, and then I extended it to boys 2 years later. So Pigtail Pals and Ball Cap Buddies. And I started creating my own apparel with designs that honored childhood, that fought gender stereotypes, and that sent really empowering messages to kids, the things that I felt families and kids would want childhood centered on. And then from there, I have a very large social media community of parents that are very active, very engaged in this discussion. You know, every day we show up and talk about these issues, whether it's our Facebook community, on Twitter, the blog. And then I've just written and released the book, and it's just sort of a roadmap and full of tips and everything that my husband and I have done for our daughter, and things I share things from the community, the research I've done, you know, through social media, this aggregation of voices over the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, that's interesting, because one of the things you say is that once you realize what you're seeing, the gender definitions being so pronounced, that you feel like you're an island and no one else is there with you. But now you've got, you know, your book and your social media community, and you want to draw people together around this issue and provide a toolkit for parents and who feel the same way that you do. What kinds of areas do you cover for parents?
Yeah, so we talk about gender stereotypes both in media and in products, and we talk about sexualization, and we talk a lot about just sort of gender politics as it relates to children, just then sort of the upside of it, which is a lot of imaginative play, free play. We talk about good resources, positive products and picks and things like that.
And it starts in the home. You know, the parents are a huge influence, obviously, for most children. What can they do if they want to create a home environment that feels more freeing and doesn't feel like it's confining girls to a particular gender stereotype?
Well, one of the first things I tell parents is that it's never too early or never too late to start. So no matter what age their child is, and if they just have girls or have a mix of boys and girls, like I'm raising a boy and a girl. And so we apply these concepts to both of our children. And basically, it's offering the whole world to their child. So make sure that there's blocks and cars and dolls and a train table and a toy kitchen and all of these things that help with socio-emotional play and then also help with cognitive development and different milestones for the children. Because that's true for boys and girls. That's not defined by what sex the child is. Like, young kids need to develop all of the same things and same skills and same, you know, amount of awareness about the world and their place in it. And I feel that, you know, the marketers have done an excellent job telling parents what boys should be, what girls should be. But if we really pay attention to our kids, we get a different message. And that is that they want to explore everything. And when we give them the space to do that, we see their personality come out. So then we might see a little girl or a little boy who's obsessed with princesses and fancy dresses and wands and tiaras, and that's okay. And we might see a little girl who's obsessed with cars and footballs, you know, and that's okay. So it's about letting the kids have the space to show us who they are and really respecting childhood and the space that needs that childhood needs to take place and to happen naturally and organically.
A writer named Lisa Bloom wrote a piece in Huffington Post a while back, an opinion piece about how she feels that when you see a little girl, you shouldn't focus on how she looks, that our natural tendency might be to say, oh, you look so pretty today. What are you wearing? Are those butterflies on your shirt? And she tries to heal herself when she does that, and that it's more important to ask, what are you reading? What are you thinking about? Do you agree that how we talk to girls affects how they see themselves?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've tweeted back and forth with Lisa about her piece, and it was great. Definitely, how we respond to and interact with girls helps them shape and frame how they see themselves in the world. So if the first thing or the only thing we're focusing on is their looks, it begins to tell them that's the most important thing about them. And it just simply isn't true, because just like any human being, little girls are very complex, diverse creatures. And so it's okay to, if, you know, a little girl has something interesting on her shirt, like, you know, a dinosaur or a fish or maybe a place, like, you know, maybe it says Madison, you know, Children's Museum or something like that. Ask her about those things, but make it kind of open-ended questions so that she can tell you about herself. Even if her shirt's blue, just look at it and say, oh, that's a really cool color of blue. It reminds me of the ocean. And then maybe that gives her the space to say, oh, I've been to the ocean. It was so neat. Let me tell you what I saw, as opposed to, oh, you look pretty today. Because then what is she supposed to say? Just kind of smile sweetly and say thank you, but that doesn't really allow her to be or do anything, whereas the other set of questions allows her to be a person that shines through, is interesting and intelligent and creative and things like that.
So moving ahead in years, at some point a girl, as she gets older, probably will go through a phase where she will want an outfit that looks something like Miley Cyrus would wear, or, you know, something, will want a Barbie with the high-heeled feet that go right into the shoes. How do you suggest parents deal with that when they don't agree with it, when it's actually the child who wants to move in that direction?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think there is a natural tendency that as we, you know, grow up more like in the preteen and then the teen years, where we do start to care about our appearance and the face we put forward to the world. And we kind of want to have a strong personal brand, which is something I talk about in my book. And it's okay to care about your appearance and sort of the overall package that you're presenting. But there's a difference between, you know, putting your best face forward and being obsessed about your looks or your weight or trying to force who you are, who you look like, into this very narrowly defined version of beauty. And so, you know, with like the Barbie thing that usually comes before the girls wanting the sexualized outfits, with the Barbie, you know, most girls get their first Barbie around age 3. So So, and the sexualized outfit stuff, that kind of, from what I hear from parents, my daughter is turning 8 next week, so we haven't gotten into this yet, but from what I hear from parents, that's about age 9, 10, 11. So with the Barbies, the parents can just sort of ask questions to their daughters, like, do you think her feet are comfortable if they're arched and pointed like that all the time? Like, do you think her toes get tired standing on her tippy toes? Like, does mommy wear high heels all the time? Like, mommy is a surgeon or mommy is a dental hygienist. Like, would I be able to wear high heels like that to my work? You know, things like that. And just get the child thinking. And you don't have to say to her, you know, oh, Barbie is this, you know, part of the patriarchal complex. Because your daughter's going to be standing there looking at you like, what? And that's, you know, they don't need all of that information. You know, just like we cut food into bite-sized pieces that are age-appropriate for our children, we have to do the same thing with media literacy. And so give the children the information they need to make good choices, because the other side of this is that if you are the parent saying, oh, no, no, you can't have that, it's not healthy for you, the child's going to want that more than anything else in the world. But if you get them to think critically about that kind of thing, then they're making those choices for themselves. And then you're winning the battle because they're deciding for themselves what's healthy and what's not. And you kind of have to give a little. Like, I'm not a huge fan of the sexualized dolls or the fashion dolls, but my daughter does have some Barbies that fit within the personal brand that our family is helping her build. So she has some of the mermaids. She has the dolphin trainer, things like that, because the dolphin trainer comes with flat feet and aqua socks and a fanny pack full of smelt fish for the dolphins, as opposed to a dress that looks like she's going clubbing and, you know, stiletto shoes.
Right. All right. Well, lots to talk about as we continue our conversation with Melissa Atkins-Wardy right now. She's the author of the book Redefining Girly, How Parents Can Fight Stereotyping and Sexualizing of Girlhood from Birth to Tween. She also blogs at pigtailpals.com.
We'd love to hear from you on this. Do you think being girly has a limited definition of our culture? Are you worried that girlhood is being sexualized or narrowed down to that pink aisle at the store? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now we're asking the question, is childhood for girls being hijacked by stereotypes and sexualization by the media and marketers? Our guest thinks so. We're talking to Melissa Atkins-Wardy. She's the author of the book Redefining Girly.
We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234, your thoughts, your questions, and maybe your experiences. 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
And before we go to the phones, I want to ask you, you've said that you think the sexualization of childhood will be seen as the children's rights issue of our time. What makes you think so?
Yeah, it denies children, boys and girls, their right to naturally and in a healthy and age-appropriate way develop their own sense of sexuality. And that's a big part of being human and being, you know, an adult and balanced and just a part of this world. But when it's co-opted by marketers and sold to meet companies' bottom lines, at the earliest ages of childhood, it's perverse. And I think parents really need to take a hard look at what messages we're teaching children about their worth and value of themselves or of other people. And the macro look at this is that you could say, well, I'm not going to buy those dolls for my child, or I'm not going to let her listen to that music or dress in that way. That's not going to affect her. But here's the thing. A mile from my house yesterday, a 16-year-old girl was rescued because she was forced into prostitution. Now, the guys were arrested. It's, you know, that's great. Hopefully they'll be brought to full justice. She's hopefully being healed and taken care of. But what the sexualization does is blurs the line of taboo between children and sex, and that taboo has to stay in place so that we don't have 8 and 10-year-olds being trafficked into prostitution. And that's the far end of this spectrum. But if you go to Toys R Us tonight or Target and you look at some of the dolls on the shelf, there's not a lot of difference between them and some of the stereotypical sex workers that we see. And when we have that as the baseline for femininity that girls grow up with, that boys regard, you know, as being in, being related to girls, there's a really, really big problem. And one of the tests I ask my community to do is if you take that cartoon or you take that doll and you could put it on a billboard for a strip club and it doesn't look out of place, we really, really need to question what it is we're letting our children grow up with and why we're allowing these companies to continue to do this to childhood.
That's an interesting case. Let's go to the phones now. We've got Sarah on the line from Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Melissa. First of all, I'm so glad to hear you talking about this.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you.
And one of the things that I struggle with is I don't have children yet, but I have good friends from college that do. And one in particular that's a good close friend, she's very much into toddlers and tiaras. She watches this with her 3-year-old little girl. Her daughter wears bikinis from Target, and it's just something that is very difficult for me to watch as a friend that loves her and wants to see her daughter become the woman that she wants to be. And it's, how do you as a friend, and not only that, as a non-parent, be able to broach this conversation with a good friend and have it be received in good ways?
Okay, thank you, Sarah. That's something you talk about in your book, how to deal with this when it comes up with family and friends.
I do, yes, yeah, Sarah. I do talk about this in my book, and I think it's chapter 2, so definitely check that out. But you know, you like you said, you love your friend and you respect her, and it sounds like she's been a friend of yours for many years, so you don't want to do anything to jeopardize that friendship. At the same time, it sounds like you have a sense of responsibility to this child to be a really good role model for her. And I think even if you're a child-free adult, you still can be a very important part of these children's lives as a role model. And so one of the things you can do is model yourself and your behavior for the type of woman you want this little girl to grow up to be, because that's going to, in the end, have a larger impact on her than the couple hours she spent as a child watching this rotten TV show with her mom. And it sounds like her mom kind of doesn't understand the difference between raising a child and using the child as a doll. And so, you know, you can gently suggest to her, is it hard for your daughter to swim in that bikini because she keeps kind of having to adjust it all the time and it doesn't look like she's having as much fun as she could if maybe she was in a one-piece? And kind of present things that way, because if you say, you know, that's really going to harm your daughter and her sense of sexuality when she ages, like, the mom's not going to hear that and she's going to get defensive. And you want to be able to remain a part of her life and the little girl's life. And the other thing is when you give her gifts or present media to her or, you know, ask if you can take her to the movies, make smart choices and make choices that show the female character or the toy being smart, daring, and adventurous.
Thank you so much for the call, Sarah. And we go next to Nick, who's joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi. That's just, I got a couple comments, actually. The funny thing is we like to shop at Goodwill for my daughter's clothes because she grows out of them so fast. Well, I can't believe they make high heels for a 4-year-old. Well, my daughter found a pair of high heels for her, and she's like, Mom, can we get them? And my wife used the excuse because we could have financially bought them. We said, well, you know, we really can't afford them, Gracie, you know. But some lady, of course, comes up and says, oh, she can buy them. I'll buy them for her.
Oh.
But that made me mad because high heels for a 4-year-old. And then the other thing is my wife will watch it once in a while is the beauty pageants for kids. That just makes me sick to my stomach. Are you serious? You're gonna dress up a 4-year-old in a beauty pageant? There's just something wrong with
yeah.
these people.
Thank you, Nick, for calling with that. And what do you think about those examples? High heels for 4-year-olds and beauty pageants. Is this exactly what you're talking about?
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about. There's no need for a 4-year-old to wear a high heel. And Nick is right. Like, you don't believe it until you see it, and then you just, and it's that, you know, like we say, you can't unsee it, and that's your aha moment. You're like, wait a minute. She's a little girl. Her job is to run around and play. And at 4 years old, developing gross motor skills is still a big part of her job, right? She's learning to climb. She's learning to jump. She's, you know, testing her boundaries. She should be dressed appropriately to go to the playground and throw herself off the play structure and land solidly on 2 feet. And that builds such confidence. And so many, you know, cognitive fires go off in her brain when she does that. If she's prancing around the playground in, you know, these wedge heels, she can't play the same way. And I have parents argue with me and say, no, you should see my daughter. She runs around, whatever, whatever. You know, but the other thing is high heels aren't healthy for women's feet. And, you know, I wear them and I get yelled at by my chiropractor for doing it because they look pretty. And, you know, but the thing is, I'm an adult woman, so I can make that choice for me. When adults are making that choice for children, it's not allowing children to be children and play in the way they need to be.
But is it letting them kind of try on different identities? Isn't that part of childhood too?
That's a big part of childhood. Here's the difference. Trying on mom's high heels that are 10 sizes too big for your feet and trying on her lipstick and her pearls and her purse and kind of sashaying around the house thinking you're $1 million, or wearing all of those things that are meant for adult women but are now made in sizes for children.
In our last minute here, what can parents do? What's one thing if they really want to try to influence the culture and their kids?
look at whatever you're feeding your daughter as a media diet, just like you feed her a food diet. And like you want her food diet to be rich in nutrients and healthy proteins and grains, you want her media diet to be full of healthy characters and storylines and messages. And look at it as, you know, we talk about with food, you know, having a rainbow on your plate. Look at her media as, is it being smart, daring, and adventurous?
Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Melissa Adkins-Wardy. She's the author of the book Redefining Girly, How Parents Can Fight Stereotyping and Sexualizing of Girlhood from Birth to Tween. She also blogs at pigtailpals.com.
Coming up, we'll get the latest on the traffic scandal involving New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and how it might affect the presidential race and the aspirations of maybe Governor Scott Walker and Congressman Paul Ryan here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find out the latest on New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's bridge scandal.
The scandal stems from traffic problems back in September when lanes of the George Washington Bridge were closed in an apparent case of political retaliation. Joining us now is Neil King, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Neil, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
Well, briefly, give us, please, the background of the story. What happened?
Well, I mean, going back to early September, all of a sudden people noticed in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which is right on the banks of the Hudson, right at the foot of the George Washington Bridge, that the traffic patterns, basically there had always been three booths going in to pay your toll. All of a sudden, the three lanes that all the traffic from Fort Lee would use to get onto the George Washington Bridge was reduced down to one toll booth. This caused huge backup all the way into the city, so that it even disrupted life in the town of Fort Lee itself. So questions were asked, why did this suddenly change? What brought this about? And it remained a mystery, with early on some suspicions that some kind of vendetta, some sort of some retribution of some kind was being exacted. But so that kind of rattled around. The election happened. Chris Christie was reelected by wide margins. And then various reporters, including a bunch of us at the Wall Street Journal, started writing, even in the middle of September, looking into this. Why had the Port Authority ordered this, et cetera? So lo and behold, Christie, of course, had denied that there was any involvement by his staff. That was several weeks ago. And then, boom, the morning before last, out come these emails that show that people very senior in his staff, up to his deputy chief of staff, actually had knowledge. When you go sort of thinking of like what kind of smoking gun, if you actually have a smoking gun of an email from a deputy chief of staff of the governor saying, let the traffic problems begin in Fort Lee, you know, it doesn't get much better than that. And so all of a sudden, Governor Christie, you know, presumptive GOP 2016 presidential front runner, among other things, and kind of a darling of the party since he won his big reelection in November, has a big problem on his hands, a big credibility problem, and also a problem where all of a sudden the image that he had built up as gruff, sometimes, you know, in your face, straight talking, but ultimately kind and well-meaning governor was looking very bullyish. And that's going to be a problem for him, potentially.
He tackled this head on in a long apology press conference yesterday. He said the buck stops with me, though. He said he didn't know about this. He did not give that order. He was not informed. His staff, he said, lied to him. He apologized to the people of the city affected. What do you think, or what's been the reaction nationally to this apology so far?
Well, I mean, the reaction yesterday after that really pretty extraordinary press conference, which was a great vintage Christie performance, almost 2 hours, took 90 questions. The reaction, particularly among Republicans, and particularly those who support him, which is a large portion of the establishment of the party, was, wow, good job, showed sort of Christie at his best, out there, forthright, taking responsibility. But there's also just a lot of overhang apprehension, because there's a lot of not only unanswered questions, but a lot of stones that still have to be unturned. And he is going to face very large exposure for a long time as a whole bunch of different inquiries now unfold. The entire press corps is looking through all these documents. 1,000 more documents came out today. The Democratic Party of New Jersey and nationally has been totally activated. And because of the blanketness and the emotional, you know, straightforwardness of his denials of any kind of knowledge, if knowledge starts to come out or anything links him to this after all, you know, that could be really damaging. So his exposure is large.
We've got a few, as you mentioned, inquiries, a class action suit from some New Jersey residents. I imagine more may join that suit. Is that something that's going to keep this alive for a while into the future?
That's a good example. I mean, so all of a sudden you have this, what they want to at least have to make into a class action suit of people that were affected by this, these 4 days of traffic jams. Then you have the state legislature itself having subpoena power and doing its own investigating. And then you have the U.S. Attorney's Office, which yesterday announced that it's going to look at least whether there was potentially some federal crimes possibly involved in, you know, closing off portion of a federal interstate system for political purposes. So that's just some of it. And then the other thing that's really worth noting, I think I was just looking through my Twitter feed before we came on, and, you know, coverage and sort of the way people look at you, particularly from the reporting side, really matters a lot. And, you know, going into this, Christie was a person who had a certain sort of Teflon coating. Now, all of a sudden, the whole vein of reporting has been opened up. So, you know, one of the stories I saw, 8 videos of Christie yelling, name-calling, and belittling people. Or, you know, it's another story that somebody had dug up. Meet the other mayor that's accusing Chris Christie of retaliation. So you have this whole can of worms that's being opened where it's going to be, you know, full season to look at sort of this other side of Chris Christie that very few people would have paid attention to a month ago. And that's not going to be good.
Looking at Governor Christie's presidential aspirations, let's suppose that the class action suit, the federal, the legislative inquiries are all best case scenarios for him. It turns out it's exactly as he said yesterday. He didn't know anything about this. How much in that case damage do you think it does to his presidential hopes?
Well, I think it's going to take, and it already will have taken some of the gloss off. You know, after, in the last couple of months, when people go out and ask nationally, who do you like for the 2016, he has been the front runner. You know, he gets about 25%, something like that, and then it falls off. But that's normal when you're 2 years out. And the thing about him and what gives him the kind of popularity and what makes him really be seen by a lot of the establishment types is that he has a broad level of support. Women tend to like him a lot more than is normally the case with Republican candidates, Hispanics, et cetera. So we're gonna have to see to what extent there's sort of a damage that's been done because of people looking at him in a different way, maybe even whether he or not he was involved directly with this. It's the idea of like, well, is this sort of the attitude, the kind of culture that he has created or encourages within his office? We'll have to see, and it's going to take a little while before we have any kind of data, but there's I think it's pretty certain that he's going to take some hit in that regard.
There's a wide hypothetical field of GOP presidential hopefuls, including 2 men from Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker, Congressman Paul Ryan. Who, if anyone, would benefit from backsliding in the Chris Christie momentum?
I think both of those two certainly would. I mean, you know, there's a big kind of just to the right of the middle sort of lane that is clearly open that I think may be one of the most promising lanes to be in 2016.
As long as it's not closed.
Exactly. Or the toll's too high. You know, if he suddenly is crippled, you're going to see Jeb Bush run look all the more promising. Certainly somebody like Scott Walker. I think Paul Ryan would be a decent candidate for that. Or you also start to bring other people in, like Rick Snyder in Michigan, who isn't often talked about, but he would be somebody that would very much fit that bill. And it's also about where does the donor class, the big money type, sort of start to look as an alternative to Chris Christie. Money and organization matter a lot, and if people start to lose confidence in him, the next thing is like, well, who will step up to be the one that sort of, you know, receives the benefits of that, the spillover?
It's January 2014. Is this the kind of thing that we're all buzzing about now, but in a year and a half when people start running their primary campaigns, visiting Iowa, that sort of thing, we'll sort of vaguely remember it as a distant bit of history?
Yeah, Probably and possibly. The thing that's so hard to predict in these things is, so he had his big press conference yesterday. Everybody thought, "Phew, we escaped a bullet there." But this is just sort of the first phase of one of these things. And for all we know, we'll be looking back and say, "Wow, we thought he had gotten, you know, everything looked great for him on that Thursday, and now 2 weeks later, can you imagine what? Can you believe what happened to the guy?" Or it could be the other way around, and he does sort of come out of this relatively unscathed, and we look back and kind of laugh at the conclusions, because a lot of people, both like Glenn Beck and various of the conservative talk radio people that are no fans of Chris Christie, have already written off his presidential aspirations, and you find a lot of bloggers on the left having done the same. Those all may prove to be premature, that's for sure.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it was a real pleasure.
That's Neil King. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. With the chili season underway, our buddy Ian Knauer joins us now about how to cook something warm and yummy for winter: soup.
Ian Knauer is a farm-to-table chef and the host of a new PBS series called The Farm. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So until recently, we have been having crazy cold weather here in Wisconsin. Is it kind of similar out in Pennsylvania, or are you enjoying balmy 60-degree weather?
Oh, it's been crazy here as well. 2 days ago, the wind chill was minus 20. Today it's a balmy 34. So
that's so decent.
Yeah,
it's still
cold.
Soup weather, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is the time of year when you want to snuggle up on the bearskin rug in front of the fire and just have a nice big bowl of steamy soup.
So sometimes I get the urge to make soup. I don't have the right ingredients. I don't want to venture out in the cold to get the other stuff. What do I have to have on hand to guarantee I'm going to have enough to make at least a decent basic soup?
Well, I mean, you can. The beauty of soup is that you can really stretch the limits both laterally and longitudinally. If you have a liquid and anything that has flavor, you can stick it in a pot and boil it and add enough salt, and you're going to have something that's going to resemble soup.
I can see Rob thinking of unfortunate things.
Twinkie beer soup.
Yeah.
Actually, that wouldn't be bad at all. In fact, there are lots of beer soups. If you look to like a cheddar soup, a cheddar broccoli soup often has a beer base, and beer is one of those ingredients where you probably have a can of it or a bottle of it in your fridge somewhere, and if you use that instead of water, you're going to add a lot more flavor.
Well, besides the beer, you're also a fan of having celery, carrots, and onion. What's special about that mix?
Well, so this is a classic combination. So whenever you have celery, carrots, and onions, you have what's called in French cuisine a mirepoix, and that is the base of just about everything, from stocks to sauces to soups to braises, because those three flavors work in combination with each other. You have celery, which is a little saline, it has some saltiness to it. You have the onion, which has an earthiness to it, and then you have the carrot, which has a sweetness to it. And when you combine those three things, you get a really balanced flavor.
So how do you go ahead. How do you get started with those?
So these are also things that most people, or at least most people who cook, have on hand. You probably have, you know, half a head of celery and a couple carrots and maybe an onion or two laying around your kitchen at all times. So even if you only have that, you can make a really good soup. In fact, I make one called a mirepoix soup, which is basically a carrot soup that's heavy on celery and onions. Because those flavors are so balanced, you end up with a soup that has a lot of depth to it. So the way to get started on a soup like that, a really simple soup, is to dice up all your veggies, cook your onion in either some olive oil or some butter until it's brown, because by browning it, you get even more flavor. And then add your celery and add your carrots. Maybe go two parts carrots to one part celery, one part onion. And then add whatever liquid you happen to have. It could be white wine. It could be chicken stock. It could even be water if that's what you've got.
Will you get a decent flavor if you're only using water?
You will, actually, because of the combination between the carrot, celery, and onion. They have enough flavor to really bring some substance, bring some foundation to that soup anyway. So you boil it until all the veggies are tender, and then blend it up. And if you've got a little cream, throw that in there. Actually, if you have a little some chili flakes, or even even a little anchovy paste, just a teaspoon or so. Put that in there. Your soup's not going to taste like anchovies, but you'll be surprised at how much depth you add just by adding that power ingredient.
So this sounds like a great starter, too, and you can start throwing in other, I'm imagining, veggies or maybe even meats. What kind of things can you add to your, I'll try it, mirepoix to take it in a new direction?
You got it, yeah, good pronunciation. Well, meats would be a really good addition to that because, of course, meat has a lot of flavor. And if you're adding some meat, it could actually be any sort of meat. If you have some beef, you could cut that up into cubes and brown that along with your onions. Even if you have ground beef, you could throw that in there. Of course, veal would be decadent and lovely. Chicken would be great. Even boneless chicken, boneless skinless chicken breast, which, you know, doesn't always have a lot of oomph to it. If you brown it enough, that chicken will actually add to the liquid that you add. So even if you add water to that soup, that chicken will actually make it into a chicken stock. So you'll end up with something that has a lot of flavor there.
Now, a couple things I like to add. I usually cook vegetarian soups. I will add soy sauce, or sometimes I'll add a veggie Worcestershire sauce. And I feel like those might function the same way as your anchovies do.
Well, they do. In fact, Worcestershire sauce is not vegetarian because it has anchovies in it.
My version is, though.
So be careful there. But soy sauce is a great addition there. In fact, anything that's fermented like that will give you a nice, deep flavor. So if you have tamari or if you have miso, would be great in there. That will give you a lot of depth in your soup. And still keep it vegetarian.
And we've got a recipe for your carrot soup based on this mirepoix on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR, along with, I think it's, Veronica, it was a black bean soup that Ian sent us?
Right, a vegetarian, I think, black bean soup, but I'm sure you could pop some bacon into it if you wanted to.
Well, that wouldn't hurt. The nice thing about that bean soup is that it actually brings you this sort of satisfying feeling. And it's not necessarily from flavor, although beans have a really nice flavor, but it's from texture. So if you have a soup that really coats your tongue, coats your mouth, you get the sensation of satisfaction. And this soup, you not only blend the beans up, so you blend it in the blender, so it gives it a viscosity, but you also add some coconut milk. And coconut milk is one of those vegetarian substitutes for something like cream. And it really gives you that that satisfying mouthfeel. It's very comforting soup.
What is the flavor like with coconut? Does it end up tasting kind of tropical?
Well, no, not exactly. And that's sort of the interesting thing about it, is that it adds more texture than it does flavor. And the flavor of the beans is quite robust. And I think there's some onion and some garlic in there, too. So mostly it tastes like black bean soup. But the coconut milk does add a little bit of sweetness, which helps balance the savory aspects. But then again, you know, going back to the viscosity point, it's really much more about the texture.
And you did a little cultural detective work to come up with that coconut milk idea, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is based on a soup that I grew up eating as a child. My mother is from Baltimore, Annapolis area. And so we would go down there in the summers and even in the winters and eat at a restaurant called Middleton's, which is in Annapolis, and they would have this famous black bean soup. Now, black bean soup, you know, where does it come from exactly? And so I did some digging, and chances are that this particular black bean soup probably comes from an African-American influence. So there was probably a black cook in the kitchen there who used to throw all the bones that they had in some simmering water and along with the black beans, and then ended up with this really African-influenced soup. That sort of speaks to soup in general. I think some of the best soups that we have worldwide come from cuisines that are not necessarily affluent. So you have poor cuisines like Brazilian, or even, you know, even if you look to France, you have some country soups that are really satisfying, and they start with basic ingredients like bones and stocks, bay leaves, and you end up with this soup that really, really comforts you.
What do you think about the whole texture of soup question? I know some people who don't like it to be too pureed. They think it's too much like baby food. What do you think about chunky versus pureed?
I think it depends on the soup. There are some pureed soups that really hit home with me, and then there's some chunky soups that are even, you know, border on stews that I find to be really satisfying as well. So if you have chunks of meat in your soup, you don't necessarily want it pureed. But if you have a really delicate vegetable soup, then that can be really satisfying when you puree it. You get that viscosity, you get that texture when you puree the soup.
We've got your carrot soup. We've got the black bean soup with the coconut milk. Anything you've been kicking around for your next soup experiment as the winter grinds on?
Well, I have to say a tip that I follow and that I think any home cook should sort of invest a little time in, because it doesn't really take much, is some freezer space. So any time that I roast a chicken, for instance, I save the bones, or a turkey, I save the bones and I throw them in a big Ziploc bag and I put them in the freezer. Or any time I want to have shrimp cocktail, I get shrimp with the shells on and I save the shells in a bag along with, you know, any leftover lobster shells or fish bones, anything that, you know, from the sea. And then when the bag gets full, I throw it in a pot with a mirepoix, so with an onion, some celery, some carrots, maybe some leeks, some bay leaves, whatever I happen to have on hand. And I just simmer that for about an hour, and I end up with a stock. And then that stock goes in containers and goes back in the freezer.
All right. So some good tips there about stocking our freezer. Ian, we're out of time, but thank you so much for coming on and talking soup.
Oh, thanks for having me again, and stay warm.
That was Ian Knauer. He's a farm-to-table chef and host of The Farm.